This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Womanjika, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to use a word in the Kulin language. My name's Richard Watts, and before we begin, I would like to respectfully acknowledge that we are meeting today on the lands of the Kulin Nation, and to pay my respects to elders past and present, and the elders of any and all communities who may be with us this evening for Penny Arcade Bad Reputation.
Hi.
Before we proceed, can I ask you to please switch mobiles, pagers, beepers, things that go ping in a loud and annoying way, either to silent or off? Let's talk about Penny Arcade, about her work, and especially about gentrification. But Penny, as I'm sure you know, is one of a handful of artists who created performance art as we know it today.
For which I apologise to everyone everywhere.
She is a contemporary of the likes of Patti Smith and Debbie Harry. Quentin Crisp, who she performed with, described her as his soulmate and the woman he most identified with. I thought you were about to give head to the microphone for a moment there.
Well, you know, it was escaping from me. Look at that. See, if I was 23, I could get a grant for this.
Now, can I get a quick show of hands? Was there anybody who has in the audience who has seen Penny on her last Australian tour when she did Bitch, Dyke, Fag, Hag, Whore? Yes.
Oh,
excellent.
Oh, look at, not that many people. I thought it was going to be all people who saw Bitch, Dyke, Fag, Hag, Whore. Now, I see you guys in the back there, too. But it's interesting, isn't it? So you've come for other reasons. And I'm going to find out what those are.
Now, at the end of tonight's event, there will be a book signing, courtesy of Hares and Hyenas Bookshop, who are up at the back of the room. So do stick around, purchase a book, and Penny will be signing those for you. And also, keep some questions in mind, because in the last 15, 20 minutes of the show, we're going to throw it open to you, so it's not just me kind of interrogating Penny.
And I just want to tell you, those questions could be what you want me to talk about. It doesn't have to be that you have a question. It might just be of an idea, you know, so that this is useful, not just another narcissistic display.
So, Penny, given that you are identified with the avant-garde, I wanted to ask you to begin with, what is your personal definition of the avant-garde? What does bohemian mean to you?
Well, first and foremost, you're only avant-garde during an avant-garde period. So I started in the late 60s, which was an avant-garde period. So I remain avant-garde until I die. Young people who are, because avant-garde is not a style. It is not Art Deco. It is not American colonial. It designates a period, and people don't understand that. People are always saying, oh, I make avant-garde work. That's dumb, okay? That's inarticulate and beneath you, okay? Anyone who is working now, you know, and say working from 1978, 81, and after, is working in a rear guard, in the rear guard, which is very important. The rear guard takes up what was done in the avant-garde and moves it forward until the next avant-garde movement appears, which, as we know from history, usually occurs about 30 years, between 25 and 30 years, or 16 and 30 years after the fin de siècle, after the new century. So we could be expecting that maybe something new will start somewhere between 2016 and 2030, one hopes. So bohemia. Bohemia is where the demi-monde, which is the criminal world, and where the demi-monde, the underground, is where bohemia and the demi-monde, the criminal world, intersect, right? I come out of the underground. Bohemia now has really been co-opted. You know, there's this whole concept of bourgeois bohemia, which is, of course, impossible. That's like being an atheist Catholic, you know, unless you're Graham Greene, who was an atheist Catholic. So what I say is, if you do not have a functioning criminal class in your art scene, you have academia. And while academia is a reflection of the art world, it can never be the art world, okay? It only reflects the art world. So I don't know if I've been clear. Because somewhere around 1992 in New York, they started saying I was bohemian. And up till that time, bohemian was really an old-fashioned word because there had been a bohemian movement, which was what came before the Beats. So in my immigrant, working-class, peasant relatives who lived in the village, who I would go there to cage food occasionally, I once dropped LSD. 1967, I was going to go and meet friends of mine in the East Village. I ate at my Aunt Lucy and Uncle John's house, went in the bathroom, dropped the LSD, started to leave, and my Uncle John said, "Where do you think you're going?" I said, "I'm going to meet my friends in the East Village." He goes, "You can't go out there." He said, "There are bohemians out there." And I said, "Bohemians?" I said, "No," I said, that was before. I said, "There have been beatniks, now there are hippies." He didn't care, he wasn't letting me leave. And as it turned out, by the time I finally got there, out of there, I was tripping my brains out, which led to a lot of complications that evening.
Which is a good opportunity for my next question. I wanted to ask you about your relationship with your family, and I'm going to preface this with a comment. A Melbourne writer, Christos Tsolkas, novelist. I'm sure many people in the room have read his work or are familiar with
his
work.
Okay, I need somebody to deal with this because, you know, it's becoming endless.
Thanks, John Boy. So when
Thank you, John Boy.
Christos Tsolkas.
That's John Boy Davidson.
Round of applause for John Boy.
Oh, there it is. Thank you.
Nice. That's one.
I was getting exhausted. Thank you. Okay, so
Melbourne novelist Christos Tsolkas, parents emigrated to Australia from Greece after World War II, so peasant family growing up in Melbourne. He remembers he says when he was about 10 years old, he turned to his mum and said, "Mum, I want to be a writer. That's what I want to do." She crossed herself.
Yeah.
How did your parents and your family respond to you? Because you apparently wanted to be a writer and a performer from the age of about five.
Yeah, it was very problematic. It was problematic. I mean, one of the things that I adore about Australia and which makes me feel so comfortable when I'm here, and I don't know why I don't live here, is the fact that there are so many first generation and second generation people. And we are different than other people because we grow up in between cultures. And so, for instance, I am never going to be an American, but I'm also never going to be an Italian. And from when I first came here, it reminded me of my childhood because in my factory town of New Britain, Connecticut, in the early 1950s, everyone that I knew pretty much was either first or second generation, whether they were Italian or Syrian or Lebanese, or whether they were Ukrainian or Polish, whether they were Spanish, whether they were French Canuck, everybody was from somewhere else. So true multiculturalism means that you grow up hearing each other's languages spoken and you grow up eating each other's foods. So one of the reasons that I love Australia is because of that very thing. And I feel that when I do my work here and I talk, because I'm always talking from that outsider position, from the displaced person, that it's understood in a way that it's not understood other places. So for me, there was already a lot of tragedy in my family before I was born, and I didn't know that. I didn't find that out till about 10 years ago. Like I thought, you know, I was told that I was the first person in my family in 3,000 years who had been bad, you know. And it's an awfully long story that I don't want to take up time talking about. It's in my plays. If you read my play La Miseria, a lot of it's in there. In Bad Reputation, it's in there. It's interesting because I was always told I was a bad girl, and I'm not a bad girl. I'm a good girl. And I'm a good girl because I want to tell the truth. And we live in a convoluted culture that calls you bad if you want to tell the truth and if you want to know the truth. And it was very strange. My mother died in 2001. My mother was the Marlon Brando of Italian mothers. And my mother did what I expected that she would do. She would win our lifelong argument by dying. And it was after she died was when I found out from my sister-in-law that my mother had actually been very proud of me and proud of my work. And I've used my mother in video a lot. And at one point I say, Ma, you think it's stupid that I do theater? And she goes, if you like it, good luck. You know, very detached, because my mother was detached, and detached because of her displacement, detached because my grandmother, unbeknownst to me, I found out, can you imagine this, right? So I'm the only bad person in my family for 3,000 years. Then when I'm 56 years old, I find out that my grandmother, my mother's mother, was in prison in 1923. Okay, my mother didn't even know this. Okay, it was kept from my mother. And I think she found out in the 70s. And by then, you know, of course, I'd already been in Borstal, and, you know, they weren't going to come and say, oh, you know, actually, you weren't the only bad person. So, but there's a thing called epigenetics. Have you heard of epigenetics? It is that we carry the trauma of our ancestors. And I think we carry the trauma, and I think we carry also the joy and taste. And, you know, maybe you love the color periwinkle. It might be because some very strong ancestor of yours loved that color. And I believe, and have come to believe in the past 10 years that I found out all these stories, because in Italy, nothing ends, okay? Nothing ends. So when I went there and found this other side of my family, my grandfather's side of the family, who are all country people, they're all farmers and cheesemakers, right away they were like, the first woman I met had been a friend of my grandmother's when she was 20 and my grandmother was in her late 50s. And the first thing she said, she was crying when she found out who I was, and she said, I've been waiting for you to come for 70 years. Her father-in-law had told her that someone was coming and that she had to explain about my grandmother to this person. And then I went to meet yet another woman who was 90, who's like my first cousin, and she came out walking, 5'10", very tall, came out walking, crying and pointing to me going, do you know about your grandmother? We did not agree. And you're going, wait a minute, like, my grandmother died in 1965, but this is still going on. So I have come to believe that I was supposed to bring resolution to these issues. My mother's dead, my father's dead, my grandmother, grandfather, Mingo, my grandfather's brother, is dead. So have I answered a question about my family? Perhaps not. I did a talk at the Hawk Center 2 weeks ago, and, you know, I was trying to explain, you know, how I feel about different people and whatever. And I said, you know, I have two brothers and a sister. I said, none of them have ever seen me perform. And the entire audience went, oh, you know, and I said, no, I said, they don't hate me. They just don't go to the theater. It's not part of their culture. You know, they go to casinos, they go to restaurants, they go on cruises, but they don't go to the theater. So I think there's an element, you know, that I was an odd child. I was a reader. I went to see Matilda last night, which, by the way, even though it costs way too much money, if you have a rich friend to take you, as I did, it is the story of me. Yeah, and it's a great cast, but I was brought back to the thing of being that child who was a reader and that child who lived in my imagination, and that because I lived in this, I was the first person in my family who spoke English. And I was like constantly being drilled into my head that we were poor, we were not white, because Southern Italians were not considered white, neither in Italy or in America. And, you know, till 1978, minority in America meant that you were Jewish or Italian. And so I was having this drilled into my head all the time that I had illusions of grandeur. You know, the fact that I wanted, I wanted to be an actress, and I wanted to be a dancer, and I wanted to be a writer. These were seen with great suspicion in my family because they were frightened. You know, they thought I was going beyond my station. And so because of that, I was kind of left like that, in the lurch. Exactly that sound. I was left in the lurch and in a very dangerous position because I was alone. And as Quentin Crisp once said to me about himself, he said, "You have to understand, I had no one to appeal to." So I had no one to appeal to as a young person.
Now, speaking of the past and of culture, we've heard about one side of your past, mm-hmm. the family now and that culture. You, for you, gay men have played a significant role in your
yes.
life. Jamie Andrews, who gave you a place to live when you were 16 and homeless. The underground filmmaker Jack Smith, Quentin Crisp, who you've just mentioned. Given your connection with gay men and the gay community, tell us about the impact of the AIDS crisis in America in the 80s and 90s.
Right. Well, first of all, I mean, long before I met Jamie, when I was 14 and I was in Borstal, when I was like 14 and a half, then they let you go home if you were good. They let you go home for an overnight and then for two nights, like every 3 months or something. And I met this guy named Larry Biscaino, who was this extraordinary gay kid who, like, this is like 1964, 65, would be in a yellow suit with a flowered tie with his guitar. He had like a Beatles haircut and cars. This is like a hardcore factory town, New Britain, Connecticut. And cars full of boys, mean boys, would drive by yelling queer. And he'd go, "That's right, I'm queer. What about it?" So that was my introduction to like, whoa, I was being called a slut, I was being called a whore, I had never had sex with anybody, I was being bullied over these things because of a disowned sexuality. I didn't realize, I mean, I'm going to be 66, so just imagine me at 13, okay? So all of a sudden I saw that there was a different way to handle it. You know, I didn't have to shrink and you know, be small, you know. So he took me to my first gay bar where I met my first transgendered person. And afterwards, you know, he said, "Well, what did you think of Natalie at the door?" I said, "She's very pretty. She's very nice. She let me in." He said, "What else do you think about her?" And he was like dancing around me. And I said, "She's really a boy." He said, "And what do you think of that?" I said, "She looks like Elizabeth Taylor." So I was never, I think because I knew that I was bisexual from a very early age, from like when I was five. Yeah, okay. It was never a blip on the screen for me. Being queer just never meant anything to me. I thought it was completely normal. I thought that everybody was like me. And so when I met these guys, when I met Larry and he took me to this gay bar, and it's an amazing thing. I hope I get to bring this show sometime. I have a show called Old Queen, and it's about, I've only done it as a work in progress, and it's about how when I was 14, 15, 16 years old, hanging out in the gay bars of Hartford, Connecticut, Providence, Rhode Island, Provincetown, Massachusetts, New York City, that my goal every night was to get to sit at the table with the old queens. A very difficult invitation to get for a teenage girl. And unbeknownst to me, I was on a trajectory to become an old queen. And now I am an old queen, but in a culture that has lost the meaning of the value of old queens. But the thing that was interesting is I did a work in progress of this show in San Francisco in 2009. And at the end of the night, before the show, this guy came up to me, and he said, "Well, I came because I read that you used to go to these gay bars in Hartford, Connecticut." And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, I used to go there." And I said, "Okay." Then he said to me, "Did you ever know Inga?" And I said, "No, I don't know who Inga. I'm sorry, I didn't know." He goes, "She was a transgendered woman." I said, "I'm sorry, I didn't know her." And he was so sad. He said, "Well, she died 5 years ago. She was my best friend." And I didn't know what to do. I had to go on stage, but I was like leaving him in the lurch. And I just looked at him and I blurted out, "Did you ever know Billy Hansen. And he looked at me and he went, Billy Hansen was Inga. So then I go on stage and I said, well, Billy Hansen is all over this story. I go on stage and I do this whole play, and he's in the front row. No man, all these names that I'm mentioning, he goes, he's screaming, Larry Biscano, Aggie. He's saying all these names, and then finally the show's over. I went over to him and he said, I remember you now. I said, you do? He said, I didn't like you. I was like, how come? He said, because you were clearly underage and you were going to, he goes, you were there dancing all night at 2 o'clock in the morning and you were going to get us all arrested. And so that was the beginning of my journey into a public life, because I didn't have an identity. I mean, I was given this identity of the town slut and whore and all this sort of thing. Suddenly, here I was in a world where of gay men, where everything that made me wrong in my hometown suddenly made me right. That I was funny, that I was outspoken, that I had a sense of myself, that I was outgoing. And this was supported, and these gay men demanded this from me. You know, they demanded it from me. And it's not, you know, it's interesting because there weren't many lesbians. Lesbians didn't really go to bars, you know. And I started telling people, like, because people would hear me talk and I could dish, right? And because English was my second language, I picked up like gay language, that real patois of being gay, which really was a language at one time. And people would say, is she real? And I'd be, I'm a fag hag. And everybody would go, no, no, you're not. Fag hags are terrible. They try to have sex with men. And I'm like, I'm a fag hag. This is what a fag hag is. So I really took it on as my identity.
Now, that idea of taking on those identities leads me to ask about a project that you're involved with, the Lower East Side Biography Project.
Yes.
You talked about becoming an old queen, and one of the things that this project does is documenting the lives of old queens and other unique artists, rich people, fascinating people whose lives are being forgotten.
Well, the thing is that there's a gentrification that happens to neighborhoods and buildings and cities, but there's also a gentrification that happens to ideas. And one of the ways I explain this, as I was saying earlier to Richard, is, you know, 20 years ago, Melbourne was an incredibly hip place filled with really hip people. And today, there's still hip people here, but it's really taken over by hipsters. And hipsters are not hip, okay? Hip people create trends. Hipsters follow trends, right? So there's been a commodification of rebellion. You know, everybody has the same tattoo, so they can all look different like everybody else. And the Lower East Side Biography Project, I started it 16 years ago. It's the subtitle is called Stemming the Tide of Cultural Amnesia. And I actually coined the term cultural amnesia in Melbourne and in Sydney. I said it twice in 1994 when I first came here, because I was talking about what was happening in New York. And this project is about highly self-individuated people, because one of the things that my show Longing Lasts Longer is about is about what's happening to individuality. Real individuality is totally threatened. You cannot be an individual in the culture we're living in. We're living in a culture that is ruled by consensus, that is ruled by groupthink. If you know, you go and you write something on Facebook. I mean, I've written something on my Facebook page and people come on and they comment, because I let anybody comment on my page. And they say, I don't know why I haven't blocked you. I'm like, you don't know why you haven't blocked me? You're on my page. I don't block people. I let people do, I mean, unless they say really racist or homophobic stuff, you know, basically I let people have their own opinion. But we're living in a period where the whole thing, if you grew up in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, you were waiting to grow into your own opinions, which you knew were going to take you 10 to 20 years to develop. So now young people have bought into this thing that they come with the software. I mean, I've had people say to me in their 20s, who are friends of mine, and I have great friends who are in their 20s, and they say, well, yeah, but, you know, I don't understand what's happening in my life. I'm like, why should you? Why should you be the 27-year-old who suddenly understands what's going on in your life? Why have you bought into that? So the Lower East Side Biography Project, I interview highly self-individuated people, and it's everything from junkies to artists to, I mean, it's not about what you do. It's about who you are. It's about being, because now we're living in a mono-generational era. At no time in history has everybody portrayed as being in a scene been portrayed as being in their 20s, right? And that's what we're living in now. And so people who participate in that kind of ageism, right? Clearly not you guys, because you came to see me. They're actually accelerating that ageism coming into their own lives. So I want highly self-individuated people, because there's no longer that cultural thing. Like the East Village in the 60s, 70s, 80s. You know, if you saw somebody who was old in a bar or at a performance, you would make a beeline for that person. You'd think, my God, they must be incredible. They're still hanging out. You know what I mean? Now people are like, oh, they're old, you know? So people don't understand, and they also don't understand how quickly one becomes old. You know, I'm telling you, 30 to 60 lasts a really short time. And the thing is that, you know, and I love to say this because people are so freaked out. So many people that I'm friends with who are like around 29, 30, they're like, freaking out, because they bought into the culture, you know? Like, instead of being oppositional to the culture, which is what outsiders, what was a rock and roll perspective, they, and queers too, I mean, I'm sorry, they are annoying, you know? No, I'm sorry, because it's become this kind of like, everything is, I haven't been in Australia long enough on this trip to be able to say what's going on here. But in New York, it's a popularity contest. It's like, finally, the 10,000 most popular kids from every high school in the world are now in New York. Those are the people who most of us who went to New York went there to get away from, okay? Nobody who was popular in high school can ever be hip. It's not possible, okay? If you were popular in high school, that was your peak. Be satisfied. So the gay world, which was really oppositional, which didn't judge people in this kind of middle class way, has become that. So it's no longer, for me, it's no longer a sanctuary. This young gay guy who did an interview with me a few days ago, and he said, what is your message to young queers? I said, I have no message to young queers. Young queers are not my audience anymore. I'm not trans. They're going to see people who are trans. They're going to see people. I mean, everything has been, the whole gay world has been broken up into small, tiny fiefdoms, you know? And so we've lost our power.
The gay world has been gentrified.
It's been gentrified, and it's been co-opted so that, you know, you know, you write something. We were writing about something on Facebook, discussing something. And somebody in Australia, in Sydney, who's a trans woman, wrote something. And somebody else on the page disagreed with this trans woman. And she wrote, you're transphobic. And I'm like, no, they just didn't agree with your opinion. That doesn't make them transphobic. Next thing is somebody else is writing from somewhere else in the world who was a black trans man. You're a racist. What? Because we don't agree with you? You know? So whereas the gay world had been this place where everything could be discussed, where you could really get into what it meant to be human, what the gay world understood the human condition as only outsiders can. Only outsiders can understand really in a very central way what it means to be disrespected, what it means to be left out, what it means to be cut out. And somebody's always queer. And I just did one-to-one. I hope you'll all watch it when it comes out, I think next Friday. And I said to her, I said, somebody's always queer. I said, right now, who's queer? Heterosexuals who don't judge people on their sexual orientation. That's who's queer now. So it's very important for people, like for somebody in this room perhaps who maybe doesn't know why they're here and then they're hearing me. I try to be as absolutely honest, even when I know some things I'm going to say are not going to be popular, right? Because maybe there's somebody in this room that really needs to hear exactly what I'm saying. And I could protect myself and look better, or I could be totally honest. And that's what I try to do in my work, because it is a privilege, and especially in this incredibly ageist culture, for me to be able to come to Australia and do my work, for me to be able to be somewhere like the Wheeler Center and to be able to speak to all of you, for me to be able to be on your show, to be on the radio. You know, it's harder and harder. The world is becoming more, less and less friendly to older people. It's a very weird world out there. And I know, I think we were all equally distressed this morning when we heard, or late last night when we heard about the bombings in Brussels. It's like the world is changing in an irretrievable way, in an irreversible way. And all we really have is our individuality. Each of us, you are in competition with no one. You're in competition with no one. You have to be able to look at who you are. I saw this great thing. Watch this documentary about Louise Bourgeois, who is a great woman sculptor, who died at 99. She had her first one-woman show when she was 78. She's my role model. And I watched this very, very boring documentary with her, and I forced myself to stay with it. And I'm waiting and waiting. And the person who was interviewing her was so full of himself. And I just wanted to, like, you know, break through the TV and strangle him. And then, finally, in the last minute, she just turned to the camera and she said, what you must do is, first, you must see who you are. Secondly, you must accept who you are. And in the silence between those two things, the dialogue begins. And my show, Longing Lasts Longer, which sadly I'm only doing 10 shows in Melbourne, which I just realized like a week ago, because I'm kind of a procrastinator, so I didn't look at the schedule. I thought I was going to be here for a month, you know, because it's my ancestral home. And I couldn't believe it, but I just thought, like, wow, you know, look at you guys, you know. The world, people aren't telling you. You know, people are scurrying about, promoting themselves. You know, I care about how you are because I have to live among you. I would like there to be less assholes in the world.
Now, speaking of Melbourne, here in Melbourne, artists have often been at the vanguard of gentrification. Traditionally working class inner city suburbs, artists move in, open kind of, I don't know, cool little bars and performance venues, which eventually morph into wine bars and restaurants where artists can't afford to drink and eat anymore. How do we break that cycle?
Yeah, but see, I don't believe that it's artists are at the vanguard of gentrification. I think that's a very, very easy thing to say, because there are artists and then there are arty people. Okay? Those are not artists. Artists go to neighborhoods like my neighborhood, Lower East Side, right? In the 80s, when I moved into that neighborhood in 1981, people didn't know. I'd say, oh, I live on Stanton and Clinton. People didn't know where that was. And I'd say, well, there's Soho, there's NoHo, and I live in uh-oh. I didn't feel the need to open up a trendy boutique or a trendy cafe, right? And neither did the many, many, many other artists who lived in that neighborhood. We were not displacing anybody. Those apartments were empty because of crime and because of poverty. They were poor neighborhoods that people didn't want to live in. The problem is now that posh people want everything. They want everything. They used to come and slum in our neighborhoods, in our galleries, you know, in our performance spaces. Now they live there, okay? So the issue is not that artists gentrify a neighborhood, but that there is this kind of arty person that as the neighborhood becomes more and more established and as rebellion became more and more destigmatized, then these kind of arty people come in and they open up the restaurants, they open up the boutiques, etc. What can we do? I finally figured out when I was in London, because I could not understand. And when I'm in London, I live in Islington, which was basically an Irish working class neighborhood. Every apartment, every building was a three-story family home where the woman stayed home and the husband went out to work and the children went to school. Now, each floor of that three-family house cost £600,000 to buy. So are we to believe that in the 1970s and 80s and even 90s that poor people lived better than rich people? They had the whole house. Only one person worked. And what I finally figured out is it's overpopulation. It's overpopulation. So what we're really dealing with is overpopulation. And I don't have the answers for that. I mean, I stay in New York. People say, why do you stay in New York? I have a cheap apartment. You know, if I could get an apartment for $700 Australian in Melbourne that was, you know, in a neighborhood where I could walk around and do things and see people and the way my neighborhood is in New York, I'd move here. So how am I going to get that? Like, am I going to get that in Fitzroy? I don't think so. Am I getting that on Brunswick Street? Yeah. Like the equivalent of a two-bedroom loft? I'll come. I'm ready. I'm ready to migrate. I'm also up for marriage. Anybody, I mean, I will come and work for gay marriage, people. If you want an Italian passport and an American passport, I'm your man.
Does the Lower East Side still feel like home, or has it evolved and gentrified to the point where it's unrecognizable?
It's nerve-wracking. I mean, you know, a lot of my friends died. You had asked about AIDS. You know, over 300 friends of mine died. I had an experience last year. We showed my film about Quentin Crisp, The Last Will and Testament of Quentin Crisp, and at the Museum of Art and Design. And then we were upstairs. There's a restaurant bar that's owned in part by one of the greatest AIDS doctors, Dr. Brian Saltzman, who took care of so many of our friends, and I can always call him, and he will see people for no money. He's an amazing, amazing guy. And he owns part of this posh restaurant, who knew, on top of this museum. I'm up there with a bunch of people who had worked with me, who had been my dancers in the past. A lot of the famous burlesque people now were dancers of mine, like Dirty Martini and Tigger and these kind of people. And in comes this guy with silver hair. And I looked at him, and he was very youthful looking, very handsome, you know, obviously in his 60s. And I looked at him, and he went, Penny Arcade. And I said, I know you. He goes, you don't remember me. He goes, I'm part of your original audience. And he turned to these other people and went, I'm part of her audience, the part that didn't die. And I just looked at him, and I said, I remember you. And he goes, you don't remember me. And I said, yes, I do. I said, you used to come to my shows in the 80s, in 85, 86, 87, in drag with a couple of your friends. I said, he goes, oh, my God. He goes, you remember? I said, yeah. I said, because you had glitter in your beard, which I hate. And I said, one of your friends was HIV positive and went to live in Boston. And he said, oh, my God. He said, he just died this year. And then he turned to these people and he said, she was the best. He said, she would have become nationally famous. Her audience all died. And it was a staggering moment for me because it's something that I know, but to have somebody else who experienced it say, yeah, her entire audience died. And how do you explain that? I mean, how can I explain to people who didn't have that experience? But there are, some of us are still around. You know, I mean, I know a lot of, I mean, I grew up in that neighborhood. I grew up in public since I was 16 years old in that neighborhood. I know everybody who's left. And I also, you know, like my thing isn't like, oh, you weren't around in the 80s or 90s, so you're not cool. That's not me. I don't believe in that. You know, I make friends with people who want to be friends. You know, there's only two kinds of performers in the world. The ones who want to be friends with everybody and the ones who want to be worshipped and adored. And unfortunately, that's settled by the time you're 9 years old. You know, so I still know everybody. People depend on me. You know, beside being a performer, I'm a problem solver. And I stick my neck out, and people know I stick my neck out. So people will come to me for help. When I was living in L.A. part-time, I met this guy who made this great documentary on these black dykes in Queens. And they were called, oh my God, what are they called? They're called the aggressives. So they're really butch dykes who identify as women and as lesbians. How far out is that? And he had made this documentary, and I was somewhere, and he came up to me, and he said, oh, are you living in L.A.? And I said, yeah, I'm living here a lot of the time. And he goes, oh, my God. He goes, you can't leave New York. You can't leave New York. I mean, if you leave New York, it's all over. And I thought, is it possible that people really think that way? And then I know that because in the past few years, we've lost a lot of amazing, iconic people, like Judith Malina of the Living Theater, 87 years old, who could roll a joint with one hand. I'm talking about people who were like, you know, outsider, you know, who created, you know, the culture that everybody's involved in right now in the 40s. Like they were the architects of the counterculture. Taylor Mead, the great Taylor Mead, who was a Warhol superstar, he died 2 years ago at the age of 86. We're losing Thule Kupferberg, oh my God, of the Fugs, which was the first punk band, you know. Extraordinary people who were generous, really generous, you know. And I used to follow Taylor Mead around when I was 17, and I wanted to be like him. You know, when I grew up, I wanted to be like him. And unlike the world that we're living in right now of emerging arts, which is completely bullshit, okay? Emerging arts is a Ponzi scheme. You know, it disrespects the artistic process. It disrespects young artists because it makes people feel that just by going to art school for 4 years, you're an artist. And then people give up before they ever really develop their own vocabulary, which takes 20 years to do. But I'm getting lost, but doesn't matter. You're psychic. You can fill in the empty spots.
You were talking about your audience. Let's, I was going to say cross to them now. I've done too much radio. Let's hear from the audience. We have some roaming mics for questions. Could we raise the house lights a little bit, please?
Yeah, so
we
can
see the people kind of who are out there. And maybe a question or two. I think our people with mics will select the
While audience. You're finding them, I want to tell you that all of you can write to me at Penny Arcade Superstar on Facebook. I write to everybody. You can't be my friend, but you can follow me. And like I said, I use my page like a magazine. So I introduce a lot of other artists, you know, because you can't come and see me all the time. And or else you can write to me on my my personal email, which is MS, like Ms, like feminism, like we're hoping. mspennyarcade@gmail.com. And I love to write to people because it's so much easier than working.
Let's have some questions.
There's a person raising their hand.
Yep.
Sorry, just the microphone.
Thank you for sharing your past.
In the name of the Truth Fairy or the Easter Bunny, there's a lot of evil intolerances going on. How do you handle faith and its future?
Well, I always say that hope is a killer. I have never been a hopeful person because hope has never been held out to me. I never had any hope. But I always had faith. And I think that that's a really interesting question, because if you can get very close to your own backbone, if you can really identify what you believe in, you know, values are things that we pay for on the installment plan. You don't just like take on a value. Oh, I'm not racist. Oh, I'm this, you know, or I'm that. No, you have to live it. You have to pay for it as you live. But if you can get really close to who you actually are, you will find faith because you are here. You know, I'm not Elizabeth Gilbert. I listen to her on, you know who she is? Eat, Love, Pray. I, you know, like Oprah, you know, I was like, really? You know, but I'm an anarchist. And as Judith Malina said, and I love this that Judith Malina said, I'm an anarchist. I'm an optimist. And I do believe that we're here for a reason. I believe that the people who are in this room who have come to see me tonight are specifically the people who were supposed to see me tonight, that I have a relationship with you. And I don't know why, and you don't know why. You're here. We're here together. I'm here with Richard. I'm here with
John Boy
Davidson, I got it, with Colin Atkinson, who brought us out here, with Sarah Green
Tree.
Green Tree, exactly. Imagine her name is Green Tree. That everybody who's here, in my incredible producer, Daniel Clark, who arranged for me to be here, like, it's all happening for a reason, and that we have to have that belief that we're here for a reason. And no, like Elizabeth Gilbert's like saying, oh, everybody's an artist and everybody's special. It's like, you don't have to be special. You're only here for 80 years. You know, we're here for such a short time, but we have a reason to be here. And we have to find out what that reason is. And we can't be like advertised to that you have to be an artist. Like, who cares about artists? I'm so sick of artists. You know, you have an art scene when you have one-third artists to two-thirds people living an artistic life. An artistic life is much harder to live than to be an artist. Very few artists live an artistic life. And if you want me to talk more about artistic life, you write me and I'll orient you. Person back there, raising the hand, there.
I'm just going to go first because I don't really know what I want to ask you, but you're saying everyone's here for a reason. Like with Donald Trump,
yeah.
Like he's on the one hand, like I hate him, but on the other hand, he's saying don't be so politically correct. There's things I kind of like as well.
What do you like? Please give me one idea.
Well, he's making everyone be aware about hatred and what we should do not to be so hateful.
Yeah, but he's not doing that consciously.
Yes, I want to know what you think about him. And oh, yeah, conscious. I forgot about
I
that.
I think
yeah.
that I wrote a
piece. But I'm just with politics in general. Yeah. I see, okay. We can't really throw stones in Australia.
I think that we are living in we are barreling towards totalitarianism. I think that very soon we're not going to be able to travel at all. I think that we're living in what the Hindus call Kali Yuga, which is this incredibly dark period, and I don't know what to do about it. To me, Donald Trump is a symptom of what's going on in America. Americans are chauvinists. We are brought up to want to be the greatest country. Even me, who is barely identified as an American, except that I like to drive. You know, I want America to be the greatest country. I want the dollar to be the strongest currency. We're brought up with that. We are living in a country, we're coming out of another long war that we did not win. We are in another long depression where people have no money. You know, this is typical of what has happened at other periods in America's history and in the world's history, where people become more and more right-wing, more xenophobic, more racist, more everything. And that is why my complaint about the gay world that I grew up in was a place that was pro-feminist, was anti-racist, was working for civil liberties, wasn't just like involved in like RuPaul Drag Race. I love RuPaul, but if you know what I mean, what I'm saying is we've lost a great deal of our political power, and really, gay people want to be married and they want to join the army? Really? Like, really? So I'm an anarchist. If you want to be married, gay gesund. The only reason to get married is for a passport, like I was talking about earlier.
Another question down the back.
Penny, I saw you 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah, 22.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you for actually being a woman with a voice, because most women with voices are told to shut up. They're put down still now as being aggressive if they say their piece. The things you've said to me tonight have just made me feel so happy. Calling people assholes when I know they fucking are, it's just made me feel so great. I just think that you need to spend more time in Melbourne, because we've got huge problems here. We are homophobic, we are racist, we have just issues of hate. We are dominated by wealth. We're in a terrible state, but I don't want to bring that on your head, because you're doing okay, all right?
Well, I just want to say to you, and to say to all of you, you know, when you go and see somebody and you feel like you're like a fan of somebody, that you need to remember that you're bringing 90% of that, you know?
You remind me of me.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But I mean, what I'm just trying to say is that, you know, I hate that celebrity thing. I hate that, like, oh, I'm a fanatical fan of this person or this person. And I want to say to them, you know, you're bringing 90% of that.
Yeah.
But wait a minute, stop talking now so I can finish the sentence. All of you, when you are like a fanatical fan of Patti Smith, or you're a fanatical fan of Miranda July, or you're a fanatical fan of Sandra Bernhardt or Margaret Cho, or whoever, of Penny Arcade, you need to know you are providing 90% of what that means. You're a fanatical fan of Madonna. You're providing 90% of that. That's you. It's not them. If I'm triggering something in you, like people write me all the time, you saved my life. I'm like, you know, I actually didn't. Because I have a lot of trouble with my life, you know? So if something I say supports you, that's you being proactive. You know, I'm here, I'm a reminder. You know, I'm here to remind you and to remind myself. And then when we're all together like this, that is what becomes special, because when we're gathered together, we can reinforce each other. And that's what we need. I don't know where the world's going. Not good. It's not good. You know, and I don't believe that we can change the world. I believe we can change the world around us. And that's what we have to do, if only for selfish reasons. So I hope you're going to come and see my show, which is actually funny. You know, you need to know the show's funny. And I'm only doing 10 performances unless they bring me back. So participate in that, okay? And tell everybody you know that Penny Arcade's back in Melbourne. And that will be helpful, even if you're young and you know other people. Just, you know. Yeah, because I did 100 shows here, like 40,000, 30,000, 40,000 people saw me. So I'm back. I wasn't back before, but I'm back now, and I'm coming back again.
I think we've got time for one, maybe two more questions. So
there's a person.
Hi, Penny. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
I'm profoundly impressed by your hair, and I just want to know if it's a bitch to upkeep.
If it's what?
If it's a bitch to keep up.
Yeah. Because my hair grows really fast, you see?
Oh, okay.
Well, I'll show you. This is where it's, you see where it's grown out? I have to do my hair every 3 weeks.
Oh, okay.
And if I wasn't doing the show and did all the publicity photos, then I'd go back to being either apricot, which is a good color that I'm doing. I never dyed my hair till I was 53, because my mother, she would have like ragged on me endlessly. Yeah, I was oppressed by my mother. Yeah. I like this color.
Another question.
Well, the questions have really degenerated. I love that you asked that question. At least you didn't ask the question which people come up to me on the street and they go, do you buy your clothes to go with your hair? I'm like, no. I like all the same colors. So everything goes with everything.
Do we have another question on this side of the room? Or, yep, just...
Hi, Penny. Thanks for coming.
I read
Chris Krause's I Love Dick recently, yeah. Which is having a bit of a moment here at the moment.
Yeah.
And in that, she writes that, Karen Finlay's the fake, but Penny Arcade's the real deal. And I was just wondering, how do you continue to live in a way that's authentic and the real deal when there may be...
Well, it's a curious thing because somebody in Edinburgh wrote this review and said the same thing about me and Patti Smith, And the thing is that, how can I say this? Look, in 1988, Vogue magazine did an article about me as a performance artist, right? And people are talking about. And my mother's response to me being in Vogue magazine was, hey, that magazine costs $3. If I could have found, there were so many ads. If I could have found it while I was standing in the checkout line at the supermarket, I wouldn't have even bought it. So how much of an egomaniac can you be? The great writer, and you should all, since you're people who read, you should read the great Bruce Benderson. He has an amazing book called The Romanian, which is one of my favorite books, and it's about his year-long affair with a Romanian hustler. And as I like to tell young queer people, he didn't win the biggest queer literature prize. He won the biggest French literature prize, right? And he says... Penny Arcade, you have inverted your narcissism. So one of the things I say is that life has kicked the shit out of me so many times that at this point I am virtually shit free. and the thing is that you, at a certain point, approval was too expensive for me when I was young, the price of it. And then approval has no value when you're old, So I just kept going. And I think that that's one of the things that I can really bring to you, is that you can keep going and that you can keep becoming who you are and becoming more of who you are. And we've all been less than we want to be. And we all yearn to be more integrated, to be more ourselves. And Longing Lasts Longer, the show that I'm doing here, is all about supporting individuality. It's all about authenticity. And it's also somebody speaking who is sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You can only get that point of view from somebody's over 60. You can't get it from people who are under 60 because they didn't live it. It's a copy of a copy of a copy. I mean, I was looking at this thing in Vogue magazine where they were showing, in your Vogue magazine, where they were showing like some current person, I don't know who she, oh, maybe Dakota Fanning or something, wearing a tiara. And then they show Courtney Love wearing a tiara. And I'm like, okay, I was wearing a tiara in 1982. Where am I? And by the same token, it's really funny because life passes so quickly. And it's hard for us to make sense of our own lives as it's passing. All I know is that in Vogue magazine, they have those sections called Beautiful at Any Age. And it's they have your 20s, your 30s, your 40s, your 50s, your 60s, and your 70s. I looked at them like, oh, my God, I only have 2 sections left.
Time goes far too quickly, which means we are out of time. Just a reminder that Penny Arcade's Longing Lasts Longer. She's performing at the famous Spiegel Tent at Art Centre
Melbourne.
It's
so beautiful.
10 shows only, so don't forget to book by
calling Ticketmaster. With an incredible rock and roll sound score from the past 50 years where you can, like, it's like you just rock out in your seat. It's, like, incredible.
Please thank Penny Arcade.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.